Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Show Talk with Angela Butler. I am your host, Angela Butler. Tonight we have with us Attorney Lisa Anderson, the attorney from Panama City, Florida. She is going to be talking about stand your ground. Stand your ground. She's not the attorney for any of the people down in Sanford, Florida, but she's going to be explaining stand your ground and what it means in the state of Florida that George Zimmerman used as his defense to the police for the fatal shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Attorney Anderson.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. And you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Thanks for having
me. I'm glad. Oh, you are more than welcome. How long have you been in practice, Attorney Anderson?
I've been in practice for a little over 12 years. I have concentrated in criminal defense for the last 10 years. My first job out of law school, I was a judicial staff attorney where I assisted judges in researching the law whenever they would have decisions to make. My practice is focused on criminal defense, misdemeanors, felonies, DUI cases, shootings, all types of crimes.
Okay. What is your educational background?
I'm a graduate of American University in Washington, D.C. I got my law degree at Stetson College of Law in St. Pete, Florida in 99.
Okay, very distinguished, very distinguished. Do you belong to any professional organizations?
Yes, I do. I'm a member of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. I'm a member of the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. I'm on the Normal Legal Committee, and I also, in order to be a practicing attorney in Florida, you have to be a member of the Florida Bar. So I am a Florida Bar member, authorized to practice in all jurisdictions within Florida.
Okay. All right. All right, so that provides your credentials, and you're certainly a legitimate lawyer.
Yes.
Let's go into the questions. What exactly is the stand your ground law, rule, a statute? What exactly is it? Is it a law? Is it a rule? Is it a statute?
Well,
what is it?
It's a statute that's created by the legislature, and we've had actually all the way back to common law England, which is where a lot of our laws came from, the ideas behind them. We've had it around for centuries. It was codified by our legislature many years ago. It's under Chapter 776 of the Florida Statutes. Anyone can get on Google and find out the state of the law as far as what the black letter law is. When we talk about stand your ground law, it's not talking to one specific circumstance. There are several different circumstances when we kind of talk about stand your ground in a bundle. It depends on where you are, what you're doing, whether or not the defense is available for you. But there are different provisions within that statute that allows you it allows you immunity to exercise deadly force based upon certain circumstances. Within our jurisprudence, we've always viewed a man's home as his castle. So historically, there's always been a right to defend yourself with deadly force within your home. And in 2005, our legislature expanded the justifiable use of force into different circumstances. Now, we always have had a use of, a way to be able to exercise the defense of yourself when you're within your home. What's changed in 2005, and this has actually been the subject of a lot of discussion among other defense attorneys throughout the state of Florida for many years, and it was actually kind of predicted that something like this would happen, or it may turn in, could potentially have the possibility of turning our streets into a Wild West, shooting matches. But when we talk about stand your ground, it's going to be important to the circumstances, and every case is highly fact-specific, and I think that it's really, really important that at this early juncture when we're talking about Mr. Zimmerman and his, you know, potential assertion of that defense, that we really don't have enough facts right now to know exactly whether or not they apply. But just in talking about it in generalities, you always have a right to defend yourself with deadly force when you're within your home. Now, under the defense of your home, home protection is Florida Statute 776.013. You have a right to home protection. And the statute allows a presumption that if you're in your home and someone is breaking in, the statute says that you are justified, that it is reasonable, and we will presume it as a society that you are in, that it's reasonable for you to be in fear that you're in jeopardy of some sort of great bodily harm or death to yourself or someone else. And then that allows you to use that defensive force. And under that statute, it actually recognizes dwellings. In some circumstances, a dwelling can be obviously a residence. It could also be an occupied vehicle if you're talking about an RV, a camper, you know, someplace that you sleep, a conveyance overnight. And then the law allows you to do that in those circumstances to defend it with deadly force. Within that presumption statute, defensive force, the person who's using it, it's presumed that they're, you know, that they're going to do you some sort of bodily harm. Now, there's also an exemption in the statute that sometimes law enforcement are coming to people's houses or serving search warrants in circumstances, that there's a section in the statute that talks about that, because when law enforcement enter a home, they're supposed to announce, you know, who they are and what they're doing. So you wouldn't be able to get out if someone searching your house in those circumstances. What we're talking about from what the early facts in the Zimmerman case that kind of separates it from what I've been talking about is we're talking about this is not in someone's home. This is somewhere out in public. And I think that's more the vernacular of people when they mention the stand your ground law, that's what they're talking about. And in order to use the immunity, and the immunity is codified in Florida Statute 776.032, in order to do that, you have to come into the situation with clean hands, and it's a civil term, but you have to be doing something that you're lawfully doing. And under that statute, immunity from criminal prosecution, that actually applies across the board, pre-trial, trial, you know, at any point. And the thing that's interesting about that is historically in statutes, our legislature in order for that to be brought up, it's a defense at trial rather than a bar to prosecution. So a complete bar to prosecution, total immunity, is something that's very rarely seen in statutes. Things that the upheaval among the colleges and people calling for the arrest of Mr. Zimmerman and faulting the police in the circumstance, I don't think that we can just blindly lay that at the door of the Sanford police. Under the immunity provision, the section says that the police officer, police agency, can't arrest the person that's using the force unless it first determines that the probable cause, that there's probable cause that the force that was used by Mr. Zimmerman was unlawful. So that's kind of a different circumstance. It requires the police to do more investigation than what they ordinarily would have to in any other circumstance. Normally, police officers can arrest upon probable cause that a crime has been committed. And, you know, given the circumstances, you know, generally, a police officer would be able to, you know, to almost find probable cause in any type of shooting when you've got, you know, a killing of a human being. But that statute requires the officers to do more and to do more investigation than they normally would. So, you know, as far as the delay and the outcries for the arrest of Mr. Zimmerman, I think that it's premature because the statute has that provision in there that the police have to find a negative in this circumstance.
Okay.
How does stand your ground work? You already explained how it works. How do you assert it?
Well, in order to assert it, Mr. Zimmerman wouldn't have to, and to my knowledge, I don't think that he has been arrested. It sounds like that they're still in the investigative portion of the process. But it doesn't have to be asserted. Whenever someone is under investigation for any type of crime, our Constitution allows us to remain silent. In other countries, they have an inquisitorial type of, court process or pretrial process where you have to cooperate and tell the police what happened. My standard advice when people come to talk to me before they've been arrested or they think that they may be arrested about, for some circumstance, my standard advice is not to say anything. You need to exert your right to remain silent. Because many times when, if law enforcement wants, then they can cherry pick what facts that they want to write down for their probable cause narrative. I don't know whether or not Mr. Zimmerman has waived his right to remain silent and is giving interviews, but in order to he doesn't have to assert the stand your ground at this point. He has the right to assert his right to remain silent, but the stand your ground assertion can be made at any time. If someone's arrested, if the police, after they've done their investigation, and if they find that the immunity provision does not apply, once he's arrested, at any time he can then file a pretrial motion to dismiss based upon the statutory immunity provision. So he doesn't have to assert it right now, because at this pre-arrest phase, it's incumbent on the police to prove that he did not have the sufficient cause to exert deadly force in that situation. And if they don't have any statements from him, it's going to be awful hard for the police to prove that if there are no other witnesses or no other circumstances. But as far as the stand your ground goes, it can be raised pretrial at a dismissal motion, where the judge would actually be the one to determine, take evidence and would make credibility determinations and assess the evidence. But it can also be raised at trial as a defense. And that's actually a strategy call, because every case is different. At dismissal hearings, it's much easier for the state to get in evidence that they ordinarily would not be able to get into. So, when it's asserted, it can be asserted any time, really, and it just depends upon the circumstances.
All right. Who makes the decision if the stand your ground applies? Who did you say makes that decision?
Well, the statute that talks about the immunity provision, 776.032, makes the police officers, the law enforcement agencies, they can't arrest the person for using force unless it determines that there's probable cause that the force that Mr. Zimmerman used was unlawful. So law enforcement would be the one to make the initial assessment. And my experience, law enforcement generally file charges pretty freely. So at the first level, it would be law enforcement. It's incumbent upon them to do that. Once the charges are filed, the state attorney's office, whoever ends up prosecuting the case, and generally when you have a very politically charged circumstance that's happened, usually the local state attorney will ask the governor to make an executive assignment. And the governor will assign a special prosecutor from a different area of the state, just to insulate the prosecuting authority from any sort of allegations that they're showing favoritism on one side or the other. Then the prosecutor actually has the duty. Whoever the prosecutor is assigned to the case, they have a duty to make sure that the facts as they are discovered or as they lay out support the commission of a crime. So at the early stages, it's first the police have to make an initial determination, and if they have a potential defendant who is not waiving their rights to remain silent, they're going to have a hard time proving it. Then the prosecutor, whoever that may be, and then if the charges will be filed, and there's actually two ways to charge a felony in the state of Florida. One way is the prosecutor can do it themselves by filing a document called an information. It's just a fancy word for, you know, I'm charging you with this crime. The other way, and the more common way that charges occur, are through an indictment process. And what that does, it actually insulates the prosecutor from any sort of allegations that they're acting inappropriately or trying to show favoritism to one side or the other. So
okay.
If the charges, if there are charges that get filed, whether it be through an indictment from a grand jury or an information filed by a prosecutor, once the discovery phase occurs, and the discovery is where all the evidence that the state intends to use against the defendant, it has to be disclosed to everyone. There's no trial by ambush in Florida. Then if the defense files the pretrial motion to dismiss and asserts the statutory immunity, the judge is the one that decides it. If that's not brought up pretrial, the jury is the one that gets to decide whether or not the defense applies.
Okay. All right, listen, we have with us Ms. Lisa Anderson, listeners, Attorney Lisa Anderson from Panama City, Florida. She is a criminal defense attorney, and we have a caller online, and I'm going to go to the caller.
Okay.
Caller, do you have any questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Okay.
The question that I had was to the attorney who's was actually in the Trayvon Martin case. In that situation where it hasn't been, I guess, without a shadow of a doubt, proven that the person that actually was perpetrating the crime, it hasn't been actually determined that they're guilty in a court of law. But if the evidence is sufficient, if it turns out the evidence is sufficient that the person was found to be guilty, in this case, what does it seem like they would base it on? I mean, from the knowledge that you have of the case, I mean, what would be the determining factor on it?
Do you mean, you talked about the shadow of a doubt, because this is a different circumstance because there has not been an arrest in the case just yet. Many times when it's been publicized, you know, we're generally a few steps through the court process. The
okay.
burden, the standard of proof that the police have to show is probable cause, and
okay.
probable cause is a very low standard.
Okay.
The only standard that's lower than that is reasonable suspicion. Reasonable
right.
suspicion to stop a vehicle, probable cause to arrest. And then there's different levels of civil burdens. Like there's a little bit higher burden, in a civil case if you're suing someone for slip and fall. Then there's
okay.
a higher burden if the DCF wants to take someone's family from them. And then the highest burden that we have is beyond the exclusion of a reasonable doubt. Now, based upon my very limited knowledge of what the facts are, if there's not a witness, then the forensics are going to be really important in the case. And I have seen news reports of a 911 audio, and the police had indicated to Mr. Zimmerman to not follow him, they would handle it. And in that circumstance, the use of force that's allowed is a little bit different, and this would be a determination that a judge would make if it's done pre-trial, because the use of force by an aggressor would be different. So if Mr. Zimmerman, if he was the aggressor in the situation, then he's not entitled to use the stand your ground, I feel threatened by Trayvon, and then turn around and shoot him. In that circumstance, a different statute applies, and that's 776.041, use of force by an aggressor. And in that circumstance, if someone is the aggressor and they are using force, they can't use deadly force. If Trayvon used force back at Mr. Zimmerman and Mr. Zimmerman thought that he was in imminent death, danger of death, or great bodily harm,
mm-hmm.
He either has to reasonably think that,
mm-hmm.
and then he has a duty to withdraw. And that's where the law had been for years, is that you have to think that you're in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm, and that you have to try to remove yourself from the situation, or you have to say, hey, you know, stop this, I'm withdrawing from contact. And if Trayvon is still continuing to show that deadly force, only then would Mr. Zimmerman, as the initial aggressor, be able to counter with deadly force.
Right.
So, you know, trying to, you know, law enforcement has a heck of a job for them in order to try to figure these things out if we don't have a witness. And if, you know, I mean, very rarely, it's not like Jay Leno, like there's a, you know, video camera following somebody around capturing them.
Right.
Okay, we've got one more caller. Caller, I'm going to go to the next caller, and then I'll come back to you, okay?
Okay.
Caller?
Yes.
Hold on.
Okay.
All right, caller, you're live. Do you have a question for Attorney Lisa Anderson?
My question is, with the George Zimmerman case, it's like he was somewhere where he was safe, and then he followed the young man. So it was almost like he was stalking his prey. And I wanted to know, how does that work with stand your ground? I mean, wouldn't he lose that stand your ground since he is the one that was actually the initial aggressor and was stalking the young man?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're the aggressor, then you don't have the same rights that you would do if someone was attacking you in your home or within your locked car or, you know, within your occupied car. You've got a duty to retreat. And once you communicate your duty to, you know, the person that you're involved in the altercation with, and they know that you are retreating, then you can use the deadly force. So if he was the aggressor, and this is, you know, kind of, this is, you know, almost the same thing that we had talked about before with the previous caller, but he would not be entitled to exert the full-on immunity. There's other steps he would have had to have withdrawn from that.
Now, with this stand your ground, the young man, let's give the defendant, or Mr. Zimmerman, the benefit of the doubt. Let's say he was there to burglarize or commit some other crime. Could he use deadly force to stop him from committing a property crime, such as burglary or theft?
Now, there's the forcible felonies are things that there you do have a right to use deadly force with, but forcible felonies are specifically enumerated. And when we're talking about, you know, using deadly force, you can use deadly force if someone is trying to commit a forcible felony. And a forcible felony, it's not just any crime. It's something that has an element of violence involved in it, like a robbery, a kidnapping, an aggravated battery. Not a simple battery, but an aggravated battery. You know, we're not talking about a simple fight when, you know, oftentimes people get charged with battery when they're actually doing mutual combat. But a forcible felony that, you know, would allow for deadly force to be, you know, met with it, you know, those are very specific. Treason, murder, manslaughter, sexual battery, carjacking, anything where there's a threat of physical force or violence against someone, then you're allowed to use it without having to be in your home and without having a duty to retreat. And you also have that same, you know, the same right to protect another person from being the victim of a forcible felony. There's no duty to retreat. So, you know, what happened there between, you know, Trayvon and Mr. Zimmerman, you know, before the initial confrontation, that's going to be really, really important.
Okay. Now,
all right,
with the stand your ground, do you have to be in your home, or can you use it, say, for instance, if you're out on the street, or?
Yes. Now, as long as you are, you've always had the right to use deadly force to protect yourself within your home. Now, you have to, when you use it in your home, it can only be against people that aren't authorized to be there, like you. There are circumstances that allow a spouse to use it against another spouse if they've got an order of protection, like an injunction against that person. But the trick is you have to be lawfully in a place where you are. So if in order to have the benefit of the defense of either, you know, in defense of the person, you have to lawfully be where you are. And, you know, the stand your ground, you know, when we talk about it just kind of in loose context, we generally think about, you know, use of deadly force. And it allows, you know, allows it as long as, you know, the defense of other people, you can actually use, and the statute that I'm referring to is, and these are all under Chapter 776.031, you're allowed to use force, except deadly force, against another if you are trying to prevent another person's trespass, or the sort of criminal type interference with property other than somebody's house, so or dwelling where they live, because if you're talking about in your house, the castle doctrine would apply. So there's different kind of levels of stand your ground. Whether or not you can use deadly force is really the real key in what we're talking about in the Zimmerman case. But you are allowed to use force to, you know, to eject people off of your property if they're, you know, committing trespasses or, you know, something else that's going on. But when we're talking about deadly force, you know, those highly specific facts are important. You know, if you're the aggressor, you do have a duty to, you know, to retreat in some of those circumstances.
Okay. We're going to go break. We're going to go break. We've got to pay some bills.
When you're searching for the latest news on entertainment, the economy, business, technology, and creative arts, choose
the Digital Conglomerate Magazine.
Not only do they give you all the latest information, but they're there for you 24/7, baby, giving you the 411 and all you need to know, baby. Visit the Digital Conglomerate Magazine online. Just Google us, baby. We're everywhere.
All right, listeners, that was Gloria McLaughlin from the Digital Conglomerate magazine. He can be found at www.digitalconglomerate.com. His telephone number is 206-279-1712. Now let's go to Exquisite Barista, a company of exquisite design.
Let's get down to business. So you're having that company function or business function, and you need the proper services to get that business menu pumped. Okay, here's the solution. Call Exquisite Barista Services. Exquisite Barista Services has the experience to create a signature beverage for your business or organization. Services also include barista training, custom beverage menu creation, food and beverage pairing, and so much more. Visit Exquisite Barista Services online at www.exquisiteexpressinc.com or better yet, call 210-701-0143. That's 210-701-0143. Don't take your chances on the other man. Get that grand plan and choose Exquisite Barista Services.
All right, that was Exquisite Barista commercial. The number is 210-701-0143. Let's not forget Demetra Stewart of Atlanta Edition Magazine, which is also an online magazine. Let's not forget Maurice and Abby Merriweather, the Visalis people, who can be found on Facebook. Don't forget to be on the lookout for filmmaker Juwanna Ramsey and his film Lost It All that will be in the film festivals. Let's not forget More Time to Sleep. Are you looking to get extra sleep at night? The More Time to Sleep system is the answer. It's insulated materials, regulated body temperature, and is moisture resistant. The More Time to Sleep system has pouches designed to hold any size bottle from any manufacturer. Picks up to 4 bottles. The Velcro lining keeps everything in place. No cords, no batteries, no fuss. Provide the comfort of your pillow with the More Time to Sleep bottles. And also be sure to check with your pediatrician on the safety and use of the product. All right, we're back with Attorney Lisa Anderson. She's informing everyone about the statute of stand your ground. Caller, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I have another question.
Okay.
Okay, another question was I think that from what I heard and what I heard in the media was basically that Trayvon Martin was actually over one of his, was it someone of someone related to the family, an in-law that lived in the neighborhood that he was in at the time of the crime taking place?
So you're your question would be like the fact that he had relatives in the area?
Yeah, was he walking home going to someone's house that he knew in the community?
I don't know what the specific facts of that are, but I don't think that would really have any sort of any legal bearing on whether or not, you know, the defense would be asserted. Because when we're talking about, let's just give Mr. Zimmerman the benefit of the doubt. If we're talking about a simple trespass to someone else's property, mm-hmm. In order for that trespass order to be authorized in the state of Florida, you generally have to have written consent from the property owner. And I guess that that's not the circumstance in this case. And if Trayvon was committing a trespass, in that circumstance, the Stand Your Ground law does not allow deadly force to be used in the defense of a trespass. So that would not be an available defense to Mr. Zimmerman. We're talking a residential neighborhood. He's got a right to be where he was. There's a big gaping hole there as far as what happened that I haven't heard anything reported on. And that could be, you know, the strategy of the defense. But, you know, I would say that would, you know, maybe something and we're talking about if the case gets to a jury, that would weigh on the side of, you know, that Trayvon was, you know, doing something lawful and doing something that he had every right to do. He was in his family neighborhood.
That he had to have written consent to be there if it was a closed-gated community?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying in general circumstances.
Okay.
We have, and usually the trespass laws are used by police to get vagrants off of business owners' properties. I just mean it in that circumstances. Because from what I understand, Mr. Zimmerman was part of a neighborhood watch, and generally neighborhood watches don't enforce trespass orders. Those are usually done by police. But trespass is pretty specific in how that works. So if Mr. Zimmerman were trying to say, hey, Trayvon was trespassing, that would not give him the right to use deadly force under, you know, and under any provision of 776.
Okay.
Okay.
Based on the facts that you know of, the fact that you know of right now in the case with Mr. George Zimmerman and the 17-year-old that was fatally shot by him, Trayvon Martin, is this a good example of a Stand Your Ground case in your opinion?
Well, it depends on, Angela, on which way you look at it. There may be a really good case to be made that it's a good example of Stand Your Ground that could have been exerted, or maybe Trayvon tried to exert it. If I know in a lot of times when we're walking in public places, if somebody walks up behind you, in our culture, you know, invading someone's personal space, that's kind of considered a little violative. If Mr. Zimmerman had followed Trayvon and was aggressive in that fact, and Trayvon felt like he was in imminent danger of great bodily harm or death by the way that Mr. Zimmerman was coming at him, then Trayvon would have had a right to exert, to stand his ground in that circumstance. So it may be a case of Stand Your Ground gone wrong. Can the state prove it? I think that's going to be a tougher issue because when we're talking about burdens of proof in a criminal case, it's beyond and to the exclusion of reasonable doubt. And what is reasonable doubt? Reasonable doubt is not only is the evidence, a conflict in the evidence, but it's also a lack of the evidence. And I think that there's not, from what I've heard at this early juncture, it doesn't sound like that there's a lot of evidence out there one way or the other. We could guess all day long about what happened, but it's, you know, incumbent upon the state, it's constitutional, that the state has to bring that evidence out. And the Stand Your Ground law actually, you know, makes that burden a little bit higher on law, or a lot higher on law enforcement to prove that his, or to have probable cause that the aggressor's force or that the person who used the force did not have, you know, sufficient cause to do it. So,
okay.
You know, from a purely legal standpoint, I don't see enough evidence. And it could be that law enforcement isn't disclosing that until, you know, they gather everything, they gather it. But based upon what we've heard, I don't think that there's enough to convict him.
Okay.
I had one more brief question. So in your experience as a lawyer, how long have you been an attorney, if you don't mind me asking?
I graduated from law school in 1999, and after you graduate, you have to pass the bar. I passed the bar then. So I've been practicing since 1999, almost 13 years.
So with your experience, since you've been a lawyer, have you ever had a case where someone was actually shot and kind of similar to this case? I mean, I guess every case is, most cases are, I mean, they may be similar, but they are different. So have you ever seen a case where it was a situation where the person that was shot was unarmed, but it was determined that the person that was unarmed was the aggressor first? I mean, because I think that I don't know what happened. You know, a lot of mm-hmm. people don't know what happened. Like you said, it was no witnesses. But if you're walking, I mean, most people that are, what would I say, rational, that think
mm-hmm.
rational, if somebody is armed, whether they were a police officer or if they were, you know, a security guard, a neighborhood watch, if they knew somebody was armed and they were not, you know, if they were a rational thinking person, I mean, you know, ethical, I mean, I'm just saying basic ethical people, they would not, if someone asked them if they were doing a neighborhood watch, you know, they didn't, just say they didn't know, Trayvon Martin didn't know who he was, but the guy
mm-hmm.
approached him and just asked him a question, right? Then I don't think that Trayvon Martin, knowing that if the person did pull a gun, I don't think he would, you know, be an aggressor and try to attack the person. I mean,
right, and that
mean, that's
makes sense.
Not.
Yeah, throughout the statute and in all of Chapter 776, it's a reasonable person standard. You know, whoever reasonably believes, you know, the force that's necessary, and you know what's reasonable. You know, and it's an objective standard. You know, who reasonably believes it.
Right.
So yeah, what you're getting at is right at the crux of the law.
Right.
That you need to use reason in those circumstances.
Right.
And you know, while we can, you know, think that, you know, who in their right mind would, you know, go, you know, turn around and attack an armed person who's a, you know, supposedly a working on a security detail, who in their right mind would do that?
Right.
You know,
nobody would. I mean, a person with basic, you know, morals, I mean, they would, you know, I mean, they just wouldn't do it. I mean, so, and if you're just speculating, I mean, I'm not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even major in criminal justice in college, but even if, as a person, because when I first heard about it, they said the guy, he did neighborhood
watch. You're breaking up, caller.
Okay. Well, they said he was a neighborhood watch person. But even if he was a security guard, from my understanding, if he was a neighborhood watch or he was a security guard, or even if he would have been a police officer, it would seem to me that within the law, a person would ask them, because even in my experience growing up, a police officer that wasn't harsh or wasn't rude would just ask you, you know, do you live over here? If you're somewhere that where you don't live,
mm-hmm.
they would just ask you, you know, if they weren't just trying to harass you, they would just ask you, you know, ethically, because
right.
you know they're, you know, a police officer. But
That's a good point, because a lot of law, I mean, within the standard training, police officers, they defuse situations all the time. So in a lot of circumstances, I mean, in most of the circumstances, the police are there to defuse a situation. And, you know, having someone who doesn't have that type of training might have escalated a situation in this circumstance.
Right. I see what you're saying. Right. Okay. So he could have said anything. What are you doing over here? Or, and not even knowing the situation, it could have been, he could have just assumed. I mean, I'm not saying he did, but he could have just
assumed. Absolutely. And you never know what's, you know, where somebody is operating from, what their perspective is, or, you know, what he had just dealt with, you know, 30 minutes before. And, you know, if Mr. Zimmerman was in a rational state of mind at the time that it happened, you know, he might have reacted, you know, based upon something that happened to him, you know, hours earlier. So, you know, these are things that we don't know. But in order for him to be able to get the immunity associated with the statute, everything that he did has to be under the reasonable person standard.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. With the Zimmerman case, how long do the police have to file charges?
They're only right under, as long as there's no arrest that's been made, then the speedy trial time start doesn't tick until the person's arrested. They would have the statute of limitations would kick in. So the police have, they've got plenty of time to work under and to file charges against him. And we're talking about, you know, depending on what charges ultimately lodged against, if there is a charge that's lodged against Mr. Zimmerman, it would depend on what degree felony. Under Florida law, that's what determines the statute of limitations, how many years the state has to actually bring charges. So, and it's actually a good way for things to happen, because in a lot of circumstances, law enforcement, they don't do as good of an investigation as they could, and they're a little hasty. They arrest someone. Once they arrest someone, that starts that speedy trial time ticking. And under Florida law, if formal charges are not brought within 180 days, if the state doesn't file it within that 180-day time frame, then they can't prosecute the person, generally. I mean, there's some exceptions to that. But we're dealing with a statute of limitations issue. So, and, you know, when we're talking about felonies, that's years, not months or days.
Okay, talking about felonies. Okay. What state crimes, if any, can he be charged with?
Well, it depends on what the facts are as law enforcement shakes them out. I mean, it could be, I doubt it would be, you know, first-degree murder. I don't think it would be anything, you know, premeditated based on what we've heard. But any type of battery charge is an unpermitted touching. A lot of prosecutors will charge shootings as aggravated batteries, you know, with intent to kill, without the intent to kill. There's a slew of things. Sometimes when, you know, those higher charges are lodged, sometimes they get reduced down to an unlawful discharge. So there's all sorts of things. But generally, Florida law looks at it in the battery context. Just like in Florida, we don't have a rape law. We have a sexual battery. So generally when there's a shooting involved and they're going to go ahead and you know, go forth on that if the person lives, it's generally in the battery context. It can be manslaughter. There's a slew of things, and it's all going to be dependent on what the facts that law enforcement. And I would imagine there's a lot of facts out there that haven't been made available to the media that will probably start trickling out.
All right. Well, I know there have been marches, there have been protests, there have been all over the country, and it's made worldwide news. So I thank you, Attorney Lisa Anderson, for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler.
Well, thank you for having me.
I look forward to having you back. You answered a lot of questions that I'm sure my listeners wanted to listen to. I'm sorry, listeners, I couldn't get to you all. Time is not going to permit that. But thank you, Lisa, and I thank you all for calling in to listen to Show Talk with Angela Butler. Okay, thank you. Next, we're going to hear Fareed Braxton.
can wash away all the dirt, but I can't wash away the pain. Cause she's gone.
With Angela Buck. That was Free Braxton. Free Braxton can be found on ReverbNation.com. That's www.ReverbNation.com. Don't forget to buy his CD and his single. And early on the show, we had with us attorney Lisa Anderson from Florida, Panama City, Florida. She was talking about the law, Stand Your Ground, and the different concepts of it and the statues of it and everything. And I hope the listeners enjoyed Show Talk with Angela Butler. I hope I've informed you, helped it to inform you and enlighten you. And thank you for coming, and thank you all listening. Thank you all listening to the show.
Sure.
All right, thank you.